Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, The Hill reported today that Democrats are, warning of some integrity issues in the November elections. Look, we know what's going on. There are threats from foreign actors all across the globe. This administration has done nothing. And in fact, there's some thought that they've actually encouraged it or allowed it to happen. And then you combine that with all the stuff that we know that they've been doing through state legislatures for the last, how many years? This is really, really a scary time and a perfect opportunity to bring on my next guest, who has written the book, How Trump Stole 2020. He's already said, I guess it's over. We shouldn't even bother voting. That's why I've asked Greg Palast to come talk with us. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
You're very welcome. It's not over.
Okay.
The fat lady has not voted. Yes, but he did steal it. It's not a prediction, Rick. It is a fact. It's stolen, but we can bust the burglary. We can steal it back.
All right, that's what I want to hear. Because, as I'm reading the title, I'm going, he's already stolen it. Damn.
Yeah.
That's defeatist.
Well, it's not defeatist at all. It's warning. It's Paul Revere time. Okay, you have 16.7 million people. Write down that number. 16.7 million people have been purged from the voter rolls. They've been wiping off voters of a certain color, the bluish ones, wiping off millions of voters. They're not counting ballots, and again, young people, voters of color, whose ballots don't they count, I wonder. And we've been to this rodeo before. I mean, back in 2000 when I uncovered that the Bush and Catherine Harris had removed thousands of black men from the voter rolls, calling them felons. Their only crime was voting while black. Well, they've taken that show on the road. Now we've removed not 50,000 as in Florida in 2000. We're talking about millions. A third of a million in Georgia. They're about to remove 152,000 in Wisconsin. Didn't Trump just win that by 22,000 votes? Okay. Yeah. So you remove 152,000. You tell me, that's a pretty good thumb on the electoral scale.
Yeah, especially Ohio, as you point out, if it's the blue variety.
Yeah, exactly. So, people are getting shafted out of their votes. That's not new. It's just that they've gotten really, really good at it. And we have this Supreme Court, or I guess they've now changed their name to the White Citizens Council, I've heard. I'm not sure. The Supreme Court has given them some new weaponry to beat the voter with. So all my book is a warning that if you take if you are aware of what's going on, if you know that someone's, trying to pick your pocket, you can get their hand out of your pocket. You can't do it unless you know the crime. And then I offer some solutions to protect your vote. We can do this.
You're absolutely right. But here's the thing. And I said this earlier that, when someone's telling you that, hey, something's going on, it's what they're thinking. So when Trump comes out and says, it's all rigged, the election's rigged, they're going to rig it, we're going to steal the election, it's where his mindset is. And he's like, I'm not going to let them steal it from me before I can steal it from them.
Yeah, well, like I say, I have a little trailer about how Trump stole 2020 at gregpalast.com. And it begins with Donald Trump saying, this election's rigged. Yeah, you know that because your cronies rigged it. And that's the issue. I wish that Hillary had said to him when he said, this election's rigged, instead of her saying, no one rigs an American election. She said, you and your cronies like Chris Kobach of Kansas, remember Mr. KKK, Brian Kemp of Georgia. He's got all these vote thieves in chief, these purging generals, purging the voter rolls, blocking you from voting. Yeah, the election's rigged. But now we have to unrig it and overcome the steal. We've done it before. Right. Obama had 5.9 million votes stolen from him. When I was running for Rolling Stone, Bobby Kennedy and I did a pretty darn good close calculation. And by the way, the president agreed with us. Obama totally said, we just overcame the steal. That's how you do it.
No, that's what he said. Like, if they're going to steal 6 million, you got to go out and get 7 million votes. And that's, that's reality.
Welcome to reality. That's what we need to talk about. That's why we need, and we have to understand why he's calling for a delayed election. We have to understand what the real agenda is and protect ourselves, including, by the way, we're about to enter into shark waters. The shark waters are called mail-in ballots. Rick, in the chapter called Mail-In Madness, I warn you that according to an MIT study, 22%, 1 in 5 mail-in ballots is never counted. The mail-in ballots aren't counted. 1 in 5. And it's not just anyone's ballot. You can guess again whose ballot doesn't get counted. A mail-in ballot's not a private ballot. The chance that it will be mailed to you is, well, you're about 1 in 10 voters will never get their mail-in ballot or be too late. And some and the rest is are subject to challenge. That's where we had over a million mail-in ballots which were challenged and never counted in 16. Imagine what's going to be in 2020.
No, absolutely. They're already setting that up, which is why, you know, I'm not opposed to the idea of doing mail-in ballots, especially during a global pandemic. But I don't see it as the answer because of just what you said. I mean, there's so much shenanigans that could go on.
Well, here's what we have to do. There's things we can do.
Okay, tell me.
22%. Okay, so 1 in 5 mail-in ballots is thrown in the garbage, basically. Half of it is because you didn't get your ballot. Half of it because someone challenged your ballot. Now, listen up. And this might sound obvious, Rick, but I had to write a book to explain it. If you don't get your ballot, you can't mail it in. I don't want to repeat that. 1 in 10 voters doesn't get their ballots. Now, are these dummies who don't know how to ask for a ballot? How about the family of the head of the Georgia ACLU, the husband of the head of the ACLU of Georgia, got his ballot the day on June 10, the day after the June 9 primary in Georgia. That is typical. But she knew enough to ask 45 days in advance for the ballot. It still wasn't good enough. And here's the biggest problem. With all I've just told you at the beginning of this program, and I asked everyone to write it down. I hope you did. 16.7 million people purged, wiped out, erased, vanished from the voter rolls. Well, if you're not on the voter rolls, you don't get your ballot.
Right.
You're not going to get a mail-in ballot if you're not registered. You say, well, I've been registered for 30 years. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? You don't know what's going on around you, because here's the deal. I was in Atlanta in 2018 where they took this new purge system for a test drive in the race against Stacey Abrams. And I was with Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin, who was going to vote for the 50th year at the same schoolhouse, and they threw her behind out. 92 years old, Martin Luther King's cousin. They said, you can't vote here anymore. She lost her registration because they said she moved. She's been in the same house for basically nearly a century, her entire life, the place where Martin Luther King used to come every Sunday afternoon for after church dinner. She lost her vote. You have to understand, you're not going to get your ballot if you aren't registered. Right now, everyone, you can multitask, get in the corner of your screen, get to your state secretary of state's office, look up your name. I did, and it said here in California, Greg Pallast, no such voter. I re-registered online. I got my ballot.
It takes a little due diligence. But this is one of these moments, Greg, where, you know, we have to really, I think, start talking about how we do this whole thing. And I don't know if you saw President Obama's eulogy yesterday, where he kind of laid out a little path forward on how maybe we make voting a little bit more easier, how we make it more centrist to our democracy, maybe undoing some of the obstacles.
Well, duh. 1 year ago today, I got married in Switzerland. Where I'm, by the way, I'm on mainstream TV. In the rest of the world, you know, you see me on the nightly news, right? I'm not persona non grata, except on the Rick Smith show. Bless you. That's why you are mentioned in the book. But in the rest of the world, they are watching these reports of mine saying, what is this? I thought America was a democracy. I mean, you have to understand, in Switzerland, where my in-laws are, you're not registering to vote. In fact, everyone votes because you could get fined if you don't. They make it easy to vote. The ballots are simple as can be. They make it so easy to cast your ballot. And why? It's a democracy. What is this thing of obstacle courses, especially for people of the non-orange, whitish hue?
Good point. The book, How Trump Stole 2020, written by Greg Pallast. You can get that online. We'll make sure we get links out and how folks can get a copy of this. I hate promoting Amazon, but I know that they sell it there. Get it at gregpallast.com.
Yes, go to gregpallast.com, and you can get it from all the usual suspects or from gregpallast.com. But the important thing is, the most important thing of how Trump stole 2020 is probably at the very back, other than your name, and the thanks to you, which are heartfelt. But also, I will hope that you will carefully read and take out and use the ballot condom, which is for safe voting. No, Rick, don't wrap it around your ballot. What you're supposed to do is follow the instructions. And number one is check your registration. Because I'm serious. I lost mine. Martin Luther King's cousin lost hers. A third of a million Georgia voters were wrongly removed before that race in 18 where Stacey Abrams lost by a couple thousand votes. They said, ooh, that worked nicely. Let's take it on the road. And they took it to Ohio. And they took it to North Carolina. And they took it to other states. They're trying to impose it on the state of Wisconsin right now. So, look, check your registration. Second, when you mail in that ballot, know the rules. Now, gregpalace.com, we're going to have some celebrities that you know, some movie stars and others who are going to help you with me, show you how to get and fill out and get your mail-in ballot counted, because 1 in 10 of those requests never get to you, but 1 in 10 that you mail in are rejected. Why are they rejected? Because there's some pimply guy in a Hawaiian shirt who's going to say, I don't like that guy's signature. Oh, postage due. Did you know that 100,000 Americans lost their vote to postage due in 16? Imagine what it will be this year. Not every state pays the postage. And by the way, if you're in like one of 8 states that require you have a witness signature. In Alabama, it's 2 witness signature. Or are you ready for this, Rick? You have to notarize your ballot. Get used to it. Learn what you have to do. It's horrible. We had a federal judge say, this is going to kill people. But the Supreme Court 3 weeks ago said that too bad. If you're going to vote and you're going to have to go to a notary public, it's a poll tax, $15, and you better stick a swab down his nose to see if the guy notarizing your ballot has the virus, don't you think? So this is insane. But the Supreme Court said too bad. Alabama can do this to you. And you say, well, what do we care about Alabama? How about Doug Jones running for re-election? The Senate is on the line.
Absolutely.
In Alabama. So don't just look. And then, well, what about progressive states like Missouri? They also require a notarized ballot. Most states are requiring excuses. Learn the rules. Go to gregpalace.com. We're going to have the mail-in rules for every state. Because while I hate mail-in balloting, you know what I hate worse? More? Seeing a lot of people die.
Yep.
I don't think you should have to die to cast a ballot. So you're going to have to take the steps to mail it in. Now, a few of you, if you're in places lucky enough to have widespread and sufficient drop boxes, so you can drop it in the box, it's much better than sending it to the post office, which may not even be there by November 3rd.
Sadly.
Don't count on it. I'm serious, okay? There, that thing can barely stand up now. Now add in 80 million mail-in ballots. And by the way, not just the mail-in ballots. Most states require you to receive and fill in a postcard saying you want a mail-in ballot, right? So it's 2 pieces of mail. Our post office is not set up for this, and we've got a president who is trying to figure out how to basically put the mailmen in leg irons.
No, they're actively trying to destroy the post offices. No question about that. No question at all. So get the ballot condom. Most certainly check that out in the back of the book. Most certainly know the rules and make sure that we actually vote.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Don't steal your own vote by saying, oh, it's too complicated. And look, in a state like Wisconsin, if you're a student, don't use that University of Wisconsin state photo ID. You got to get a special state photo ID. I know that you can get it from the Dean of Students office, which is closed for the virus, but hey, so that knocks out 182,000 University of Wisconsin students. I want people to understand the rules, what IDs if in the states that require ID. And by the way, 67% of African men are asked for their ID in states that prohibit asking for an ID. So just be aware of what your rights are. That's why I want you to not only read the book, obviously I want you to get the book. I didn't write it just for my sister to read it. I do need you to read the book so we know how the burglary is happening, you know how to prevent it, but also go to gregpalace.com so we can actually learn how to cast our vote in this storm.
Great stuff, gregpalace.com. Let me ask you a last question I've got. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, obviously, President Obama, I thought, gave a eulogy that the country needed to see actually someone who can attempt to unite the country I'm curious, you know, your thoughts. I know you've had a relationship with John Lewis. I know you've been doing this for a very long time. Wanted to give you a minute to kind of share some thoughts.
Okay, well, I actually don't want to unify the country. I would like the public to pick the president. Whether that unifies us or not, I don't know. I'm for democracy. But I will tell you this about John Lewis. Okay, he's in my film, The Best Democracy, Money Can Buy, dancing Gangnam Style. Now, you won't get that anywhere else. Okay, thank you, John, for that. And the film, the book ends in Selma, Alabama, where on the Pettus Bridge, I walk the Pettus Bridge where John Lewis was beaten nearly to death. And the point there is when he got on that bridge, they said to him, he was head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you'll never, 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 never in your lifetime see a Voting Rights Act that says that you can vote no matter the color of your skin. You will never see it. He left the blood on that bridge. Martin Luther King took his place, flew in, and took up the march to Montgomery. 50 miles later, the President of the United States introduced the Voting Rights Act and said, we shall overcome. But it wasn't the president who overcame. It was John Lewis. It was Martin Luther King. And I'm not asking you to get your head beat in. I'm not asking you to walk 50 miles. I'm asking you to go to gregpalace.com and learn how to vote so they don't shaft you out of your vote. How about that?
That is, I think that's simple enough that all of us can do. Again, the book, How Trump Stole 2020, written by Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. Greg, always great talk with you, buddy. I appreciate the time.
You're the best, Rick. Thank you.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Greg Palast. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. That was the day the long Major League Baseball strike finally came to an end. The issue that motivated the strike was a dispute between players and management over free agency. Day after summer day slipped by on the calendar with no end in sight. As a result of the strike, a total of 713 games were canceled in the middle of the regular season. And on this day, players and owners reached a compromise, which ended the lengthy strike. In the settlement, a team that lost a free agent could be compensated by drawing from a pool of players. Players agreed to restrict free agency to those who had six or more years in the major leagues. Because of the long strike, the All-Star game was pushed all the way back until August 9th. When you go to the ballpark, you're likely not thinking about labor issues. Nonetheless, the players are unionized and had to fight hard to win free agency and other protections. There have been 8 work stoppages in Major League Baseball. 1981 held the record as the longest until 1994, that is. The strike started in August and resulted in the cancellation of the whole postseason. It was the first time a major sport had its postseason wiped out by a work stoppage. The strike was not settled until the following April. But the good news today is there are only balls and strikes on the field. So, play ball. Brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I tell you, every time I talk to Greg, it's one of those things where I end up just, you know, miserable over the fact that our voting system is so, so backward. And as we talked about yesterday, I mean, I've always thought, you know, and going back to when I was 18, you know, the first thing I had to do as when I turned 18, before I could do anything else, was to sign up for Selective Service to be drafted. And you know, we haven't done that in years, but still had to sign up. It was amazing to me that at that moment they weren't going, here, now you have to register the vote, too. Because it would seem to me that you'd go, well, shouldn't one go with the other? And I did, of course. But it's one of those things where you go, why do I have to go through this process? And, you know, as Greg pointed out, in other countries, you know, it's they make it as simple as possible. And Obama yesterday, during the eulogy, you know, talked about some of those things. The idea of making Election Day a federal holiday. I actually like the idea of doing like a three-day weekend. If Mitch McConnell and the Republicans during a global pandemic and an economic collapse can take an extended weekend, why can't the rest of us have an extended weekend once every 2 years? Just kind of a thought. Or even every year. Every year, the first weekend in November, everybody takes the weekend off. We shut everything down. We have big parties. And we once we can come back together, and we vote. We celebrate our independence. We celebrate our Constitution. We celebrate our ability to exercise our right to the franchise and participate in this wonderful thing of self-governance. I mean, wouldn't you want to see somebody run on that? We're going to make it a federal holiday. Everybody gets a weekend off, and it's going to be an exercise in American democracy. He also talked about, Obama yesterday talked about automatic voter registration. It's insane to me that you have to jump through all these hoops. It really is. And I've said before, there are people who say, well, we need to end gerrymandering. I've said I'm not opposed to the idea of gerrymandering. It just depends on, you know, what you're gerrymandering for. Most gerrymandering that happens like here in Pennsylvania or in North Carolina or Florida, some of the other states that have gotten really kind of creative with their cute caricatures of you know, cartoon characters and all that. Or, you know, like where I live in the 30th senatorial district of Pennsylvania, the state Senate district. It's that little Calvin kid who's usually bent over peeing on things, only he's got a bad case of gas. That's what my district looks like. And you go, who in their right mind actually drew that kind of a district? But this is what they get. We want these voters. We don't want those voters. And I'm of the mindset, I'm not against, if gerrymandering is part of it, I'm not against it. But I would like us to gerrymander 50-50 districts. Let's actually talk about, you know, the concentration of Democratic and Republican voters in each district so that maybe ideas and competition actually happen instead of having some of these elections that are, you know, perpetually where I live 65-35 or, you know, certain places around Philadelphia where, you know, it's 99%. How about we talk about competition? I don't know, just a thought. But something better than what we're seeing coming out right now. And as I said, look, expect all of the shenanigans. This is why every person has to get out and vote. Every person has to make sure that they're registered to vote. Check your Secretary of State's website. Make sure that it's there. Call, do whatever you got to do. But make sure that on Election Day, when you show up, that your name is there. And if it's not, demand like hell a provisional ballot if you have to. No, that's not preferable. But don't walk away. That's again, how, you know, Greg's pointing out that they're going to steal this election. That's how this is going to play out. And the other side of this, the scary part for me is all of the shenanigans that have been going on with you know, with the Russians, with the North Koreans, with the Chinese. There's a lot of craziness. And we've got to be diligent in the messages that we allow to get through and the stuff that we share. You know, those chain emails of a couple years ago have gotten a lot more sophisticated. The memes and the messaging, a lot more just sophisticated and really deadly. This is why, seriously, we've got to do something better than what we've done. And when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on with China. Evidently, Microsoft's talking about buying TikTok. I want to find out about that. Also, some of the shenanigans going on. We will get the lowdown from our China expert when we come right back. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Sometimes I don't know whether to weep uncontrollably, laugh hysterically, or just throw up. I recently did all three when I saw another gusher of greed pouring out of corporate America. This one is especially nauseating, given today's raging health crisis, for the culprits are major health care corporations. One perpetrator is Larry Merlo, CEO of our country's largest drugstore chain, CVS. In this time of COVID-19, customers are surging into the chain's 10,000 stores for everything from medications to masks. Yet, the boss has blithely left many of the pharmacies so severely understaffed that they pose a danger to public health. CVS pharmacists tell of frantically scrambling to keep up with filling prescriptions, answering ever-ringing phone inquiries, giving shots and COVID tests, stocking toilet paper, tending the drive-thru, etc., while also having to meet ceaseless corporate demands for cost-cutting and more profit. The result has been a dangerous work overload, with many pharmacists handling nearly 200 prescriptions in a 6-hour shift, about one every 2 minutes. Unsurprisingly, there's been an alarming rise in serious errors and week-long delays in providing critical medications for customers. Adding to the exasperation of local managers, who are allowed no say in staffing, is the infuriating level of heedless greed at the top. The New York Times reports that while CEO Merlo has failed to fund the staff his pharmacies need, he has generously funded his own needs. He paid himself $36.5 million last year alone. Then there's the mountain of interest payments and fees that CVS is paying to Wall Street bankers and lawyers who engineered Merlo's takeover of the Aetna health insurance giant last year. This is Jim Hightower saying, so while you're being underserved at a local CVS, just remember that boss man Merlo and his merger mercenaries are making a killing.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's an interesting little tidbit. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about TikTok and how the Chinese government's using it to gather information and how we're going to ban TikTok. And you know, to kind of make it worse, I think Microsoft jumped into the middle of this. There's actually talks of Microsoft going to buy TikTok because maybe they want that information. Who knew? But here to share some thoughts on, is this a good idea, bad idea? Is TikTok horrible? And you know, what are the Chinese doing in this election? We talk a lot about Russia. What are the Chinese doing? I've asked Emily Delabriere to come talk with us. She's the co-founder of Horizon Advisory, one of those great places that keeps an eye on our Chinese friends. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me on.
So TikTok, we hear a lot, the Chinese government's using it to spy on us, to gather our data. How bad is it?
I mean, it's bad. But the threat of TikTok isn't just a threat of espionage. And this is what's getting missed in the TikTok question, but also like more broadly when we talk about what it is that Chinese systems are doing. So we're not noticing this in 5G either. Yes, TikTok gives China the chance to spy. So they get access to a whole lot of teenagers' videos. But what the actual threat is moves so far beyond that. TikTok is a massive repository of information. It's all of the information on human faces, all of the information on human behavior and what it is people watch and for what and how they react to those screens. And of course, any additional espionage material that China collects from the phone when it has TikTok on it. And when all of that is gathered together, that is so hugely valuable. That's what innovation is. That's what resources are. That's what raw materials are in our new information technology environment. And China's gathering all of it. But then one more beat beyond that is that TikTok as a platform, it becomes the architecture for not only social media, but also social interaction and then commercial interaction. How many influencers are on social media and what does that do to brands? And then what happens if China controls the platforms of those influencers and they determine how those brands do? And so China just decides which brand does well on the social media platform. Or of course, what news story is on the platform and how that plays. Like, what was the coverage of the Hong Kong protests on TikTok? Oh, wait, there was none.
Right.
Those threats are so much more dangerous than just spying. That's controlling how we interact.
No, I mean, that's, you know, the way you lay it out is, you know, when I read it, I'm going, so what? TikTok is just a bunch of kids doing videos. You know, it's just, you know, short little goofy stuff. You know, what could be the harm in that? But the way you lay this out, this is scary stuff. And look, this is how these organizations think and how they influence our elections. I mean, at the end of this, you know, when Christopher Wray, the FBI director this week, said that he's warning about China as much as Russia or anybody else, a lot of people are like, well, you know, but Russia, because all we're focused on is Russia while China's getting a free pass on all of this.
And of course, China realizes that. And so China uses Russia and uses Russia as a foil, but also as a proxy in a lot of ways. And then, of course, they're doing their whole electoral game of their own across all sorts of dimensions that are way beyond the first order blunt tactics that Russia does, and that involve using capital as well as using media and information influence, and using everything from co-opted systems like TikTok to like Chinese propaganda outlets in the US.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of it, you know, the power that, you know, when you laid it out like that, the power of making sure that they control what you see and you read and the context in which it's in. I mean, that's enormously powerful, especially in a society like ours that's heavily dependent right now on those images and on that social media.
Yeah, absolutely. And what China's adept at doing is finding ways to make sure this is the case, not just of like the Chinese owned company in the US, but also of the American company, the American media outlet, because China fuses economic strategy with its larger strategy. And so it's out there saying like the US has this open market and, you know, US players work by their commercial interests. So, oh, if you leverage their commercial interests and your large market or your dedicated capital, you can make sure that Politico is telling you what you want them to tell you about the election or about this policy or about whatever.
And you know, what's interesting is, since you brought that up, you know, I was just reading a story back from June about the National Institute of Health being, you know, basically, you know, China has bought into a lot of our scientists. They've basically, you know, corrupted the entire research arm and all of this stuff. And what's amazing to me is it's not a lot of money. That's the part, again, that I keep coming back to, going, yeah, we fund all these grants. We do all this stuff through the NIH. We do all this research, and China comes in and basically steals most of it with pennies.
It's so cheap. They have found the cheapest strategy, and it works like that across the board, because the thing is, the NIH money is always going to be there. But so, you know, all those researchers have that. And then someone comes to them and says, oh, hey, you just get like, you know, 30,000 grand more. Yeah, absolutely. And it helps that all of the fundamental assumptions undergirding our research ecosystem, as well in many ways as our information ecosystem, are about the importance of openness and about sharing, which is great. But then China says, all we're asking you to do is to share internationally, and that's normative good, right? Except China's using that normative good to acquire science and technology that it's using for a strategic offensive against our system.
So basically what you're saying, and we've talked about this before, what you're saying is they've figured out the flaws in our capitalist system and in our openness, and they're actively using it against us. So wouldn't the sane, rational person say, well, you know, these are the rules that we set up. They're just playing the game, Emily. They're just playing by the rules. There's nothing wrong here.
I mean, they're not playing by the rules is the point. Because what they've figured out is how you can break the rules in this system and not get caught or bribe the umpire. And I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to bribe the umpire. I have to go back and check because sports have changed a lot in the past few months, but I think that's still not allowed. So our problem, though, is that you can't just go and say, like, kick China out of the arena. You also have to figure out how to bring the umpires back on board.
And you know, but here's the thing. I mean, right now we're in this moment where it seems like, you know, they're basically, you know, doing whatever they want. The administration today, I don't know if you saw this, but the administration today has they say they're going to, you know, sanction this Zhejiang Production and Construction Corporation, something that Axios calls a paramilitary organization that's operating in this Zhejiang Ping place. That evidently they're you know, guilty of all these human rights violations. You know, we've all seen the video, you know, of these people being herded and into you know, construction places. You know, is this a step in the right direction? Is this what has to happen? I mean, is Trump, I want to give him credit for something. Is this something worth credit?
So, yes, right? Calling out a Chinese military civil fusion company that's participating in this, you know, deliberate genocide against a minority, that's a good step. So is saying that TikTok should be owned by a US company. But at this point, we've had so many first steps. What this administration is really good at doing is firing opening salvos against China. The thing that comes after that is the actual strategy, is moving beyond being defensive and whack-a-mole and reactive and calling out one company or another company or one, you know, lying bid on China's end.
Right.
What you have to do is say, here are all of the companies and the actors behind them that are bad, and here's how we're going to have a comprehensive response that's not just, you know, for 2 months trying to pull them out of our systems, but for 2 months trying to defend against them and create a positive alternative and then make sure that positive alternative works. Like, how long are we now into the 5G question? And has the US actually come up with any concerted effort with its partners to create a 5G alternative? And one that's nearly as compelling, and that's a positive thing you can point to, rather than just saying, why don't you rip out this cheap telecom system that's promising to let you advance? And so it's the same thing now as we see these moves against military companies. That's great. Those are important first steps. We're saying China's bad. That's right. But then you say, here's something that's good, and here's how we're following up. And here's also how we're going to convince all of you to act in a way on a commercial level and on a multilateral level that supports this China's bad strategy.
Right. So what I'm getting, what you're saying is, look, this is just another one of the, as you put it, the whack-a-mole game. They found one more. This is systematic. This isn't just one company or another. This is systematic across. This is their policy. And they're just going through with it. There probably will be some retaliation for this somewhere along the line, but ultimately, you don't think that the administration has a real plan or an idea what to do after this.
We haven't seen it yet, and the thing is that as long as we spend our capital and like our political capital and our bandwidth on these whack-a-mole moves, that just buys China more time. Because they're going to go back, they're going to, you know, rebrand whatever company we just identified and come back at us with it. And we're going to have wasted all of our time trying to pull them out of our systems. And then they're just going to keep doing what they're doing under a different name or in a slightly different area.
There's just so much here. And, you know, one of the other things I did want to ask you about, because, you know, and kind of pulling back to the TikTok thing, because, you know, there's so much. China is into so much. You know, they've got money into virtually everything. They influence so much. And as you pointed out, you know, they fly kind of under the radar to the Russia stuff. How do people protect themselves? And because this is the question that I keep coming back to and people keep asking. Look, okay, the Russians are doing these things. How do we know what they're doing? How do we see it? How do we know when we see it? And what do we do to try and stop it?
Yeah, and the thing with China is it's so much harder because their approach is so much more pervasive and just comprehensive. Like, they're not just at this to make sure that one election goes a certain way or for one election year or in one form of the information environment. What they're doing and what they've been doing for decades is making sure that the incentives of the players that influence the U.S. commercial and policy and information ecosystems are tied to Beijing. So it's no longer just what is the Chinese propaganda outlet saying about this presidential election. It's what is any outlet that gets its advertising revenue from China saying about any policy that might influence Beijing's international standing. And it's not just about which Chinese company is investing in the district of a congressional representative who's going to be voting on a China-relevant policy. It's also which congressional representative is getting money from a U.S. entity whose capital interests are tied entirely to China's. So there's so many levels you have to go back down and diagnosing all of this and what the incentives are, whether they're shaping like an election or a story that in turn will shape an election, that it's just this massive web of conspiracy, which isn't super easy to decode.
No, not at all. My head is already spinning going, yeah, that ain't going to happen. So how do we know? I mean, I guess we're screwed because the reality is our government to this point has done virtually nothing to stop any of this. Not just the Russians, but the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians, who knows? But to me, the Chinese are they're the ones who are the best at this stuff. They're the scary one to me.
Absolutely. But then you get to what we are still dealing with is information and finding facts. And those still exist somewhere, I think. So the responsibility for every one of us is to go down to what the primary sources of every story are and say, what happened here? And I mean, that's the case in disinformation broadly. It's really the same thing we do when we're worried about Russia. We say, what are the facts here? And was there a spin in this story? And which way did that spin go? And then really you piece the two together. And the other thing to know is that China is not going to want anything negative said about it. So if you're seeing something negative said about it, that probably means a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, I have a friend who was a former congressman, and he's from a rural district. He was from a rural district in Ohio, and this is back early 2000s. Early 2000s, where he had said something about China in a local newspaper, and they knew about it. It had come up in a meeting. This was before the internet, where you could search, every article ever written and have, the Google notifications and all of that. And they knew about it, which is how much homework they do and how detail oriented they are, which is why, again, we've got a guy like Donald Trump who doesn't seem to be all that detail oriented. I'm a little worried.
But that point there goes back to the election question. And China, there's a Chinese think tank that literally ranks U.S. governors by how friendly they are to China. So they're following every representative and every state and local official to see how friendly they are and also how vulnerable they are to co-option. And that goes to every level of our policy apparatus.
So here's the thing. I think a lot of people now, especially with the virus, because a lot of people are, Trump's running around saying it's the China virus, and we're all, supposed to believe that, they did this to us. I'd love to hear your thought on that. But we're at a moment now where I think a lot of people are looking at China a little bit cross. Is this an opportunity to say, maybe this is when, as a nation, we kind of move in a direction?
I mean, absolutely. That should be what this year is. So much has happened this year. Australia's burned. There's been this pandemic thing. I heard some talk about murder hornets. But also, China has taken down a thriving democracy. China has continued a genocide against a religious minority in Xinjiang. And China has lied about a virus, allowing it to turn into a pandemic that has taken down our entire system. Every one of those should be a watershed moment. And now, we're 8 months into 2020, this should be when we all wake up and say, the one thing we've learned about this is that China is not going to be a responsible stakeholder, and China is a bad actor in our system, and we all need to get together and do something about that.
But what do you say to the person who said, you know, it's kind of too late. They've infected, you know, to kind of use a pandemic frame, they've infected everything already. They own so much of our treasury, because I hear it all the time. They could collapse our economy immediately by just pulling out of the dollar. Is it too late? I mean, is it possible to be is permanent normal trade relations too much? You know, what's the direction, do you think?
Yeah, it's absolutely late, but it's not necessarily too late. We have a lot less time than we did before the pandemic. So that's one thing to flag. But at the same time, like, the U.S. still is the global leader, and the U.S. still has incumbent advantages that China doesn't have. The problem is that right now we're in a world where China has learned to take advantage of those opportunities and actually to turn them into weaknesses. So the U.S. has to, like, sit back down and say, we still have the best innovative capacity in the world. We still, no matter what we've done, have the strongest network of allies and partners. And we still have the strongest commercial sector. So how do you take those? And do you protect them from China's co-option and actually marshal them into bringing about a real effective, proactive strategic response? And if you do that, then there's no hope for China. But that's a big ask, and there isn't very much time for it.
And what do you, I guess, you know, time frame? You have 2, 5 years, year, five, what?
You know what? Before COVID, I said we have 5 years. Now, I give us 2 if we're lucky.
And I guess then the question becomes, do we have faith that Joe Biden gets this? Because the sad reality is just several months ago, he said China's not a problem. Do we have faith that now he's coming around?
This is where we come into the picture, and where, like, the citizens of the U.S. come into the picture. Washington, and that's not just whoever's president, but again, as the election story points out, this is like all representatives and also all local politicians. They should know that this is something that they have to do something about, because it's our future world that's at stake. And also the private sector needs to hear that too, because obviously government has a lot less influence these days in international affairs than does the private sector. And it should not play well for a U.S. company or a U.S. fund or any U.S. actor to be working with an authoritarian state that's trying to take over the world.
I absolutely agree, which is why I'm a big fan of Buy American, which is why I do check where things are made, and I advocate for people to do that as well. But I'm hoping that this is the moment. I'm hoping we move forward. Emily, as always, great talking with you. Scary, but great talking with you. I appreciate the information.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff, as always. Emily, our China expert. Make sure you check out their website, Horizon Advisory. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day striking auto workers in Cleveland, Ohio, defended their picket lines in what is known as the Battle of East 140th Street. Members of UAW Local 45 at GM's Fisher Body Plant had been on strike for 3 weeks. They had joined striking GM workers at 12 plants throughout Michigan. They demanded a supplemental agreement granting skilled workers wage increases, overtime adjustments, and seniority, and apprentice provisions. In Cleveland, strikers vowed to stop the scabbing and were mostly successful. Now, at the start of the morning shift, a scab attempted to plow through the picket lines at a high rate of speed. Strikers flooded the gates and brought the scab car to a virtual stop. As they attempted to convince him not